we do.
Don't you ever want to stop fighting? I asked.
Why? Jane asked.
Well, for one thing, it dramatically cuts down your chances of violent death, I said. For another thing, it'd give you a chance to live those lives you all dream about. You know, the pasts you make up for yourselves. Us normal CDF get to have that life before we go into the service. You could have it afterwards.
I wouldn't know what to do with myself, Jane said.
Welcome to the human race, I said. So you're saying no special forces people leave the service? Ever?
I've known one or two, Jane admitted, but only a couple.
What happened to them? I asked. Where did they go?
I'm not really sure, Jane said, vaguely. Then, tomorrow, I want you to stick by me.
I understand, I said.
You're still too slow, Jane said. I don't want you to interfere with my other people.
Thanks, I said.
I'm sorry, Jane said. I realize that wasn't very tactful, but you've led soldiers. You know what my concern is. I'm willing to assume the risks involved in having you around. Others shouldn't have to.
I know, I said. I'm not offended. And don't worry, I'll carry my own weight. I plan to retire, you know. I have to stay alive a little bit longer to do that.
Good that you have motivations, Jane said.
I agree, I said. You should think about retiring yourself. As you say, it's good to have a motivation to stay alive.
I don't want to be dead, Jane said. It's motivation enough.
Well, I said, if you ever change your mind, I'll send you a postcard from wherever I retire. Come join me. We can live on a farm, plant some chickens, raise some corn.
Jane snorted. You can't be serious, she said.
Actually, I am, I said. And I realized that I was.
Jane was silent for a moment, then said, I don't like farming.
How would you know? I said. You've never done it.
Did Kathy like to farm? Jane said.
Not in the least, I said. She barely had the tolerance to keep a garden going.
Well, there you have it then, Jane said. Precedent is working against me.
Give it some thought anyway, I said.
Maybe I will, Jane said. Where the hell did I put that ammo clip? Jane sent.
And then the rockets hit.
I threw myself down to the ground as rock from Jane's position on the outcropping showered around me.
I looked up and saw Jane's hand twitching.
I started up towards her but was held back by a spray of fire. I wheeled backwards and got back behind the rock where I had been positioned. I looked down at the team of array that had blindsided us. Two of them were moving slowly up the hill toward us, while a third was helping a final one load another rocket.
I had no doubts where that one was headed.
I flipped a grenade toward the two advancing array and heard them scrambling for cover. When it went off, I ignored them and took a shot at the array with the rocket. It went down with a thud and triggered its rocket with an expiring twitch. The blast scorched the face of its companion array, who screamed and flailed about, clutching at its eye band. I shot it in the head. The rocket arced up and away, far from me. I didn't bother to wait to see where it landed. The two array who had been advancing on my position started to scramble back up. I launched another grenade in their general direction to keep them busy and headed to Jane. The grenade landed directly at the feet of one of the array and proceeded to take those feet off. The second array dove back to the ground. I launched a second grenade at that one. He didn't avoid that one fast enough. I kneeled over Jane, who was still twitching, and saw the chunk of rock that had penetrated the side of her head. Smart blood was rapidly clotting, but small spurts were leaking out at the edges. I spoke to Jane, but she didn't respond. I accessed her brain pal to erratic emotional blips of shock and pain. Her eyes scanned sightlessly. She was going to die. I clutched her hand and tried to calm the sickening rush of vertigo and deja vu. The counterattack had begun at dawn, not long after we took the tracking station, and it had been more than heavy. It had been ferocious. The array, realizing their protection had been ripped away, had struck back hard to reclaim the tracking station.
Their attack was haphazard, belying the lack of time and planning, but it was relentless. Troopship after troopship floated over the horizon, bringing more array into combat. The Special Forces soldiers used their special blend of tactics and insanity to greet the first of these troopships, with teams racing to meet the ships as they landed, firing rockets and grenades into the troop bays the moment the landing doors opened. The array finally added air support, and troops began landing without being blown up the moment they touched down. While the bulk of our forces were defending the command center and the Kansu technological prize it hid, our platoon had been roaming the periphery, harassing the array and making their forward progress that much more difficult. It's why Jane and I were on the outcropping of rock, several hundred meters from the command center. Directly below our position, another team of array were beginning to pick their way towards us. It was time to move. I launched two rockets at the array to stall them, then bent down and grabbed Jane in a fireman's carry. Jane moaned, but I couldn't worry about that. I spotted a boulder Jane and I had used on our way out and launched myself toward it. Behind me, the array took aim. Shots whipped by, shattered rock cut at my face. I made it behind the boulder, set Jane down, pumped a grenade in the array's direction. As it went off, I ran out from behind the boulder and leapt at their position, covering much of the distance in two long strides. The array squawked. They didn't quite know what to do with the human launching itself directly at them. I switched my MP to automatic fire and got them at close range before they could get themselves organized. I hurried back to Jane and accessed her brain pal. Still there, still alive. The next leg of our journey was going to be difficult. About 100 meters of open ground lay between me and where I wanted to be, a small maintenance garage. Array infantry lines bordered the field. An array aircraft was heading in the general direction I wanted to go, looking for humans to shoot. I accessed Asshole to locate the positions of Jane's people, and found three near me. Two on my side of the field, 30 meters away, and another on the other side. I gave them the order to cover me, grabbed Jane again, and sprinted toward the shed. The air erupted in gunfire. Turf jumped up at me as shots buried themselves into the ground where my feet had been or would be. I was hit with a glancing blow to my left hip. My lower half torqued as pain flashed through my side. That was going to leave a bruise. I managed to keep my footing and kept running. Behind me, I could hear the crumpled thump of rockets impacting on array positions. The cavalry had arrived. The array airship turned to get a shot at me, then swerved to avoid the rocket launched at it from one of our soldiers. It accomplished this, but wasn't so lucky at avoiding the other two rockets bearing down on it from the other direction. The first crashed into its engine, the second into the windshield. The aircraft dipped and listed, but remained aloft long enough to get kissed by a final rocket that lodged itself in the shattered windshield and erupted into the cockpit. The aircraft collapsed into the ground with a shuddering rumble as I made it to the shed. Behind me, the array who had been targeting me turned their attention to Jane's people, who were causing them far more damage than I was. I tore open the door to the shed and slid myself and Jane into the recessed repair bay inside. In the relative calm, I reassessed Jane's vitals. The wound in her head was completely caked over with smart blood. It was impossible to see how much damage there was or how deep the rock fragments went into her brain. Her pulse was strong, but her breathing was shallow and erratic. This is where the extra oxygen-carrying capacity of smart blood was going to come in handy. I was no longer certain she was going to die, but I didn't know what I could do to keep her alive on my own. I accessed Asshole for options, and one was produced. The command center had housed a small infirmary. Its accommodations were modest, but featured a portable stasis chamber. It would keep Jane stable until she could make it onto one of the ships and back to Phoenix for medical attention. I recalled how Jane and the crew of the Sparrowhawk stuffed me into a stasis chamber after my first trip to Coral. It was time to return the favor. A series of bullets whined through a window above me. Someone had remembered I was there. Time to move again. I plotted my next sprint, to a ray-built trench 50 yards in front of me, now occupied by special forces. I let them know I was coming. They obligingly laid down suppressing fire as I ran brokenly toward them. With that, I was behind Special Forces lines again. The remainder of the trip to the command center proceeded with minimal drama. I arrived just in time for the array to begin lobbing shells at the command center. They were no longer interested in taking back their tracking station. Now they were intent on destroying it. I looked up at the sky. Even through the brightness of the morning sky, sparkling flashes of light glistened through the blue. The Colonial fleet had arrived. The RA weren't going to take very long to demolish the command center, taking the Khonsu technology with it. I didn't have very much time. I ducked into the building and ran for the infirmary as everyone else was streaming out. There was something big and complicated in the command center infirmary. It was the Khonsu tracking system. God only knows why the array decided to house it there, but they did. As a result, the infirmary was the one room in the entire command center that wasn't all shot up. Special forces were under orders to take the tracking system in one piece. Our boys and girls attacked the array in this room with flash grenades and knives. The array were still there, stab wounds and all, splayed out on the floor. The tracking system hummed, almost contentedly, flat and featureless, against the infirmary wall. The only sign of input-output capability was a small monitor and an access spindle for an array memory module lying haphazardly on a hospital bedside table next to the tracking system. The tracking system had no idea that in just a couple of minutes it was going to be nothing more than a bundle of broken wiring, thanks to an incoming array shell. All our work in securing the damn thing was going to go to waste. The command center rattled. I stopped thinking about the tracking system and placed Jane gently on an infirmary bed, then looked around for the stasis chamber. I found it in an adjoining storeroom. It looked like a wheelchair encased in a half-cylinder of plastic. I found two portable power sources on the shelf next to the stasis chamber. I plugged one into the chamber and read the diagnostic panel. Good for 2 hours. I grabbed another one. Better safe than sorry. I wheeled the stasis chamber over to Jane as another shell hit, this one shaking the entire command center and knocking out the power. I was pushed sideways by the hit, slipped on an array body, and cracked my head on the wall on the way down. A flash of light pulsed behind my eyes and then an intense pain. I cursed as I righted myself and felt a small ooze of smart blood from a scrape on my forehead. The lights flicked on and off for a few seconds, and in between those few flickers, Jane sent a rush of emotional information so intense I had to grab the wall to steady myself. Jane was awake, aware, and in those few seconds I saw what she thought she saw. Someone else was in the room with her, looking just like her. Her hands touching the sides of Jane's face as she smiled at her. Flicker, flicker. And she looked like she looked the last time I saw her. The light flickered again, came on for good, and the hallucination went away. Jane twitched. I went over to her. Her eyes were open and looking directly at me. I accessed her brain pal. Jane was still conscious, but barely. "Hey," I said, softly, and took her hand. "You've been hit, Jane. You're okay now, but I need to put you in this stasis chamber until we can get you some help. You saved me once, remember? So we're even after this. Just hold on, okay?" Jane gripped my hand, weakly, as if to get my attention.
"I saw her," she said, whispering. "I saw Kathy. She spoke to me."
"What did she say?" I asked.
"She said," Jane said,
and then drifted a little before focusing in on me again.
She said I should go farming with you.
What did you say to that?
I asked.
I said okay,
Jane said.
Okay,
I said.
Okay,
Jane said, and slipped away again. Her brain pal feed showed erratic brain activity. I picked her up and gently as possible placed her in the stasis chamber. I gave her a kiss and turned it on. The chamber sealed and hummed. Jane's neural and physiological indices slowed to a crawl. She was ready to roll. I looked down at the wheels to navigate them around the dead array I'd stepped on a few minutes before and noticed the memory module poking out of the array's abdomen pouch. The command center rattled again with a hit. Against my better judgment, I reached down, grabbed the memory module, walked over to the access spindle, and slammed it in. The monitor came to life and showed a listing of files and array script. I opened a file and was treated to a schematic. I closed it and opened another file. More schematics. I went back to the original listing and looked at the graphic interface to see if there was a top-level category access. There was. I accessed it and had Asshole translate what I was seeing. What I was seeing was an owner's manual for the Khonsu tracking system. Schematics, operating instructions, technical settings, troubleshooting procedures. It was all there. It was the next best thing to having the system itself. The next shell broadsided the command center, knocked me square on my ass, and sent shrapnel tearing through the infirmary. A chunk of metal made a gaping hole through the monitor I was looking at. Another punched a hole through the tracking system itself. The tracking system stopped humming and began making choking sounds. I grabbed the memory module, pulled it off the spindle, grabbed the stasis chamber's handles, and ran. We were a barely acceptable distance away when a final shell plowed through the command center, collapsing the building entirely. In front of us, the array were retreating. The tracking station was the least of their problems now. Overhead, dozens of descending dark points spoke of landing shuttles, filled with CDF soldiers itching to take back the planet. I was happy to let them. I wanted to get off this rock as soon as possible. In the near distance, Major Crick was conferring with some of his staff. He motioned me over. I wheeled Jane to him. He glanced down at her, and then up at me.
Tell me you sprinted the better part of a click with Sagan on your back and then went into the command center when the array began shelling, Crick said. Yet I seem to recall you were the one who called us insane.
I'm not insane, sir, I said. I have a finely calibrated sense of acceptable risk.
How is she?
Crick asked, nodding to Jane.
She's stable, I said, but she has a pretty serious head wound. We need to get her into a medical bay as soon as possible.
Crick nodded over to a landing shuttle.
That's the first transport, he said. You'll both be on it.
Thank you, sir, I said.
Thank you, Perry.
Crick said.
Sagan is one of my best officers. I'm grateful you saved her. Now, if you could have managed to save that tracking system, too, you would really have made my day. All this work defending the goddamn tracking station was for nothing.
About that, sir, I said, and held up the memory module. I think I have something you might find interesting.
Crick stared at the memory module, and then scowled over at me.
No one likes an overachiever, Captain, he said.
No, sir, I guess they don't, I said. Although it's Lieutenant.
We'll just see about that,
Crick said. Jane made the first shuttle up. I was delayed quite a bit. Chapter 18. I made Captain. I never saw Jane again. The first of these was the more dramatic of the two. Carrying Jane to safety on my back through several hundred meters of open battlefield and then placing her into a stasis chamber while under fire would have been enough to get a decent write-up in the official report of the battle, Bringing in the technical schematics for the Khonsu tracking system as well, as Major Crick intimated, seemed a little like piling on. But what are you going to do? I got a couple of more medals out of the Second Battle of Coral and the promotion to boot. If anybody noticed that I had gone from corporal to captain in under a month, they kept it to themselves. Well, so did I. In any event, I got my drinks bought for me for several months afterwards. Of course, when you're in the CDF, all the drinks are free, but it's the thought that counts. The Khonsu technical manual was shipped directly to military research. Harry told me later that getting to flip through it was like reading God's scribble pad. The RA knew how to use the tracking system, but had no idea how it worked. Even with the full schematic, it was doubtful that they would have been able to piece together another one. They didn't have the manufacturing capability to do it. We knew that because we didn't have the manufacturing capability to do it. The theory behind the machine alone was opening up whole new branches of physics and causing colonies to reassess its skip-drive technology. Harry was tapped as part of the team tasked to spin out practical applications of the technology. He was delighted with the position. Jesse complained it was making him insufferable. Harry's old gripe about not having the math for the job was rendered immaterial, since no one else really had the math for it either. It certainly reinforced the idea that the Khonsu were a race with whom we should clearly not mess. A few months after the Second Battle of Coral, it was rumored that the Array returned to Khonsu space, imploring the Khonsu for more technology. The Khonsu responded by imploding the Array's ship and hurling it into the nearest black hole. This still strikes me as overkill, but it's just a rumor. After Coral, the CDF gave me a series of cushy assignments, beginning with a stint touring the colonies as the CDF's latest hero, showing the colonists how the Colonial Defense Forces are fighting for you. I got to sit in a lot of parades and judge a lot of cooking contests. After a few months of that, I was ready to do something else, although it was finally nice to be able to visit a planet or two and not have to kill everyone who was there. After my PR stint, the CDF had me ride herd on new recruit transport ships. I was the guy who got to stand in front of 1,000 old people in new bodies and tell them to have fun, and then a week later tell them that in 10 years, 3/4 of them would be dead. This tour of duty was almost unbearably bittersweet. I'd go into the dining hall on the transport ship and see groups of new friends coalescing and bonding, the way I did with Harry and Jesse, Alan and Maggie, Tom and Susan. I wondered how many of them would make it. I hoped all of them would. I knew that most of them wouldn't. After a few months of this, I asked for a different assignment. Nobody said anything about it. It wasn't the sort of assignment that anyone wanted to do for a very long time. Eventually, I asked to go back into combat. It's not that I like combat, although I'm strangely good at it. It's just that in this life, I am a soldier. It was what I agreed to be and to do. I intended to give it up one day, but until then, I wanted to be on the line. I was given a company and assigned to the Taos. It's where I am now. It's a good ship. I command good soldiers. In this life, you can't ask for much more than that. Never seeing Jane again is rather less dramatic. After all, there's not much to not seeing someone. Jane took the first shuttle up to the Amarillo. The ship's doctor there took one look at her Special Forces designation and wheeled her into the corner of the medical bay to remain in stasis until they returned to Phoenix and she could be worked on by Special Forces medical technicians. I eventually made it back to Phoenix on the Bakersfield. By that time, Jane was deep in the bowels of the Special Forces medical wing and unreachable by a mere mortal such as myself, even if I was a newly minted hero. Shortly thereafter, I was decorated, promoted, and made to begin my barnstorming tour of the colonies. I eventually received word from Major Crick that Jane had recuperated and was reassigned, along with most of the surviving crew of the Sparrowhawk, to a new ship called the Kite. Beyond that, it did no good to try to send Jane a message. The Special Forces were the Special Forces. They were the Ghost Brigades. You're not supposed to know where they're going or what they're doing or even that they're there in front of your own face. I know they're there, however. Whenever Special Forces soldiers see me, they ping me with their brain pals, short little bursts of emotional information, signifying respect. I am the only real-born to have served in Special Forces, however briefly. I rescued one of their own, and I snatched mission success out of the jaws of partial mission failure. I ping back, acknowledging the salute, but otherwise I outwardly say nothing to give them away. Special Forces prefer it that way. I haven't seen Jane again on Phoenix or elsewhere. But I've heard from her. Shortly after I was assigned to the Taos, Assol informed me I had a message waiting from an anonymous sender. This was new. I had never received an anonymous message via BrainPal before. I opened it. I saw a picture of a field of grain, a farmhouse in the distance, and a sunrise. It could have been a sunset, but that's not the feeling that I got. It took me a second to realize the picture was supposed to be a postcard. Then I heard her voice, a voice that I knew all my life from two different women. "You once asked me where Special Forces go when we retire, and I told you that I didn't know," she said. "But I do know. We have a place where we can go, if we like, and learn how to be human for the first time. When it's time, I think I'm going to go. I think I want you to join me. You don't have to come, but if you want to, you can. You're one of us, you know." I paused the message for a minute and started it up again when I was ready. "Part of me was once someone you loved," she said. "I think that part of me wants to be loved by you again, and wants me to love you as well. I can't be her. I can just be me. But I think you could love me if you wanted to. I want you to. Come to me when you can. I'll be here." That was it. I think back to the day I stood before my wife's grave for the final time and turned away from it without regret, because I knew that what she was not contained in that hole in the ground. I entered a new life and found her again in a woman who was entirely her own person. When this life is done, I'll turn away from it without regret as well, because I know she waits for me in another, different life. I haven't seen her again, but I know I will. Soon. Soon enough.